Well, good morning. You might know what the forecast was for today, last Wednesday. Look at your forecast. Last Wednesday for today, it's supposed to snow. So I say that, it could be worse out. Yeah, I was supposed to got snow today. Well, I'm glad we didn't get snow. Over the past few years, we have seen people march in the streets protesting what they deem to be unfair judgments, courts, they protest the police, miscarriage of justice, and what have you. We've seen this from Florida to Baltimore to Missouri even. They protested the police and they blame the courts for many things that's going on amongst various peoples of our land. If you remember, the original reason why Colin Kaepernick kneeled during the national anthem was he was protesting the police, he was protesting the courts. And so a lot of people have that on their mind about miscarriage of justice, about courts overstepping their bounds. I'm here to tell you that out of all the trials that have ever been conducted, and all the courts that have ever been convened, there's no greater misjudgment, justice that took place in the arrest, trial, and ultimately the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Practically every phase of his suffering during that time was a direct violation of Jewish criminal law. You ever seen these websites or maybe read books where people have went back and looked at Jewish law and determined about how many laws have been violated in arresting and trying Jesus? Here are just a few. First of all, Jesus was given no defense at his trial. Under Jewish law, you had the right to counsel. You had the right as a defendant to have somebody to represent you before the judge. And Jesus was not given that. The trial was convened at night. Jewish law specifically said, thou shalt not convene a trial at night. And yet they convened a trial at night. They also not only convened the trial at night, they convicted and they executed the defendant all in one day. Again, Jewish law says you're not to do that. They even had a system of appeals within their laws in case somebody had received an unfair trial. But in the case of Jesus, we see law after law after law that was set aside because the Jews wanted him dead. And this should not come as any surprise to us. Back in Isaiah chapter 53, if you got your Bibles, turn back to Isaiah chapter 53. And let's just look at verse 8 there. I'm going to read out of the New King. I've got some other version here, but I'm going to see what the others say here. Verse 8 says, he was taken from prison, from judgment. And who will declare his generation? He was cut off from the living, and for the transgression of my people, he was stricken. Taken from prison and from judgment. The NIV, the New American Standard, says, and judgment, he was taken away. The contemporary English version, which I do not recommend anybody really to have, but you know, it's interesting to see what it says at the time. Here's what the contemporary English version says about verse 8 there. It says that he was without a fair trial. And that's true, isn't it? That's how it was conducted. And this came at no surprise to God. God knew that he would receive such an unfair trial. The Holy One of God, crucified, a man Peter describes as committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth. But when we think about the trials of Jesus, we need to think about the trials really on two levels. There's the Jewish level, and then there is the Roman level, the Roman court. Now, under the Jewish court, we read about this, of course, in several places in our New Testaments. Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22, John 18. Every gospel writer records what goes on in the Jewish court. Christ would stand before the Sanhedrin. The high priest would act as the supreme judge in the case. And he would stand there and receive the charges that are made. Of course, they brought in the witnesses. What was the problem in the Jewish court? They couldn't find two people to testify that agreed with one another, could they? They couldn't find two people to agree to the charge. Now, under Jewish law, you had to have, two or three witnesses that agreed for it to be a capital case. The Jews kept bringing witness after witness, and one would say, well, he's guilty of this, and another would come in and say, well, he's guilty of this. They couldn't find two, and finally they found two that could agree. Remember what the charge was in the Jewish court? What had Jesus done that was so bad that the Jews say, we've got to kill this guy? According to the witnesses, remember? What had he done so bad? Well, he had said on one occasion that, destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. That was blasphemy. In fact, remember when he said that? Remember when he said that about destroy the temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days? That goes all the way back to the very beginning of his ministry. It goes back to John chapter 2. The first time Jesus comes to Jerusalem during his ministry, he says this. And of course, they're all, you know, up in a tizzy about that. Because wait a minute, it takes 46 years to build this temple. We're still in the process of building it. And you said you're going to tear it down and build it back in 3 days. They didn't understand what he was talking about, of course. But that comes up at his trial over there, Matthew chapter 26, verse 60. This fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And so blasphemy was the charge made against Christ before the Jewish court. One, they say, was deserving of death. But the Jews could not carry out capital punishment, could they? Now, why was the reason why they could not carry out capital punishment? Somebody, why couldn't they carry out capital punishment? Yeah, because they're under Roman control, aren't they? The Romans have taken that away from them. And so they've got to involve some Romans somewhere along the line. Now, you know, I wonder about that. You know, they couldn't commit capital punishment. Then we go to Acts chapter 7, and they're committing capital punishment. You know, the mob ruled in that case, I believe, what happens. But they want to keep everything on the up and up as it appears now. Let's have a trial for this man here. Let's do it legally. Let's convict him. But we can't kill him. And so we've got to take him to the Roman court and before a man by the name of Pontius Pilate. Now, Pontius Pilate's going to be our man this morning as we talk about those people who are lost in the credits. He's not lost in the credits per se, is he? In fact, this is part one of two parts, because there's another man involved in what goes on here today that we're going to talk about next week. But this week we're going to talk about Pontius Pilate. And Pontius Pilate, his story is found in every gospel, isn't it? All four writers have something to say about Pontius Pilate. And what we can gather from the four writers is somewhat of a biography of this man. Not a complete one, by no means. And history has to help us somewhat in trying to fill in the blanks of what we know about this man here. And he certainly is mentioned in historical documents. He's mentioned by Josephus. He's mentioned by Philo. He's mentioned by others who are ancient historians. And so we kind of get a good idea about who Pontius Pilate was. So let me ask you first of all, what was his position in Judea? He was called the governor, wasn't he, of Judea. Now, the actual position that he held is one that was called a prefect. He was a prefect of Judea. A prefect was a man that was placed up over a particular region by the Romans, an area. Prefects tend to come from men of middle class upbringing. They were not from the aristocrat positions of Rome. They were from the middle class, but they owned property. They had some type of respect among the Romans, but they were people that were appointed by the Senate or by the emperor to oversee various regions under Roman control. It is believed that old Pilate here had actually been appointed by Caesar himself, that he was a friend of Caesar Tiberius, and then in AD 26 he had been appointed to be prefect over Judea. Now, it's my understanding that to be appointed prefect over Judea was not the greatest honor being given to somebody. No one wanted to go to Judea. Now, why wouldn't anybody want to go to Judea? Can you think? Yeah, because you got to deal with the Jews. That's why. And so you didn't want to go to Judea. Well, that's where. And the other thought is that Tiberius sends Pilate to Judea because of really what type of man he was, that he would handle the problems of Judea better than anybody else. And so there is some debate about that. So what we do know that is in Luke chapter 3 that Pilate was governor when John the Baptist began his ministry, which makes sense. If he was appointed in AD 26, and we believe that Jesus was crucified somewhere between 27 and 30, even maybe in the 33 in somebody's timelines, that makes sense that he would have been governor at the time John the Baptist, who we believe began about 6 months before Jesus began his ministry. And so old Pilate's mentioned over there in Luke chapter 3. Anybody know where his headquarters were located at? Where the prefects of Judea were located. They were not located in Jerusalem. Their headquarters were actually in Caesarea. Caesarea. There was a palace that Herod had built in Caesarea that was kind of used as the headquarters for the Roman occupation governor and some of his forces there during this time. Now, we know about a man by the name of Cornelius, who lived in Caesarea, who was a Roman centurion, so it makes sense that he would have been up there, and that's where Pilate would have had his headquarters. That's where his palace would have been. But when there was large gatherings of Jews, when they were brought together for some maybe a feast or some type of celebration, that normally took place in Jerusalem, and so the governor would travel from Caesarea and go down to Jerusalem to make sure that everything was on the up and up. You know, the job of the prefect was to maintain the peace and to collect taxes. And that's pretty much all they were really commissioned to do. Just remain peace. We had you got a legion there with you. You got an army with you, so you can do that, can't you? And gather the taxes. Other than that, the Romans were very good about having home rule. At this time, Rome controlled a lot of the known world. And they could not disperse Romans every place. But they would disperse enough to keep the peace, collect the tax, and then kind of let those areas, you know, continue in their home rule. And that was true with Judea. That's why we've got a Herod. Of course, he was a puppet of Rome, but he was there. And the Jews still thought they had maybe some home rule. The Sanhedrin was still operating. So religiously, they were still able to worship Jehovah. But the Romans allowed these conquered nations to have their home rule, just so long as peace reigned in that place. And that's why Pilate was there. So Pilate comes. He's kind of the typical Roman. I don't know how much he knew about Judea at the time or he knew about Jewish customs. It seems that there are some things that he did know, but there's some things that he didn't know, and this caused him some problems. Now, a man by the name of Philo, he was a Jewish historian. I believe he lived actually in Alexandria. Characterizes Pilate as an oppressive, greedy, stubborn, and cruel man. Now, others have said, no, Philo, he's just exaggerating, you know, on that. So we really don't know if what Philo says and how he characterizes old Pilate here is right or not. But we do know this, that Pilate antagonized the Jews on various occasions. Let me just give you some of those occasions here. First off, some of his mistakes here. And I put this under what I call Roman standards. Now, it's not like Standard Oil, if you remember that old gas station. Roman standards were things that the Romans would carry before their legions. And normally on those standards, there were inscriptions or there were pictures depicted of the Caesar at that time. The Jews saw that as idolatry. And so when the Romans would normally come into Jerusalem, they would remove those inscriptions or those pictures that were on those standards. Well, old Pilate, he comes marching into Jerusalem, and guess what? Well, he didn't remove them. And the Jews had a major riot. In fact, the riot went on for 5 days there in Jerusalem. And, you know, if he just had removed those like all the other Romans had done, everything had been fine. But Pilate said, no, I'm not going to do that. And so he allows his legions to march in. Eventually, through public pressure, he did have them remove it. So that was a mistake he made there. Another mistake was with temple funds. Now, Barry, you've been to Bethlehem and Jerusalem about, 6-7 miles? Okay. Apparently, around Bethlehem, there were various sources of water, springs. And Jerusalem was needing water. And so he had a series of aqueducts built that would carry water from Bethlehem back to Jerusalem. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is how he funded it. He funded it not by Roman money, but by Jewish money taken from the temple. And so he raided the temple treasury, took the monies in there, and used that to build this aqueduct that would transport water from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. So that was another mistake that he made there. And in this case, the riot was so bad that he had to send his legions in there with the orders not to kill anybody, not to draw your sword. Well, when you've got soldiers that had rocks thrown at them and insults and somewhat, that didn't last very long. They drew their swords and there was bloodshed. There were some Jews that were killed on that occasion. Again, this just infuriates the Jews even more. And it's one of Pilate's mistakes here. And a third one is this one. And this one may not make much sense to us here. The golden shields. These were just, again, just when you think about a shield, these were things that were hung there around the palace of Caesarea and in places in Caesarea. And again, these would have depictions or inscriptions dedicated to Rome or its Caesar. Well, the picture of Caesar was not on these shields. However, Pilate ordered that the inscription on the shields be left. And the inscriptions, again, was a dedication to Tiberius, which the Jews would have said was idolatry, and that upset them even more. The golden shields were hung there. They objected. Herod even objected on this occasion and sent a letter back to Tiberius complaining about what he was doing and violating Jewish customs. And to me, this explains, and as we read later on there in Luke chapter 23 about the animosity between the two, because old Herod went around Pilate in this case here and sent a letter back to Rome and said, hey, you need to do something about this guy over here. You know, he's causing Jews a lot of heartache and headache, and he's causing a lot of unrest because of his stupidity. Well, eventually Rome sends back a message and says, get rid of the inscriptions. And so here we've got Pilate doing some various things here that just were just stupid things. Whether he knew what he was doing or not, I tend to believe more on that he did know what he's doing, but he was trying to exercise his own muscles. Rome's perfect there in that place. And then we have in Luke chapter 13, I don't have this up here, but look at Luke chapter 13, verse 1 real quick here. Luke records something that he was guilty of here. Just really in passing by Luke here, he says, there were present at that season some who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. Now that's being told to Christ. What's maybe the key word in that there that would get Christ's attention pretty much there? The word Galilean, isn't it? Getting Christ a Galilean? And so here's Pilate who in some way has had some Galileans killed here. And all this, again, I think just says to us about his disdain and animosity that he had towards the Jewish people. And they had that in turn towards him. Now, I told you that Pilate is mentioned in various historical documents. But they were having a problem for a long time finding anything with his name on it there in Judea and places of that he would have been connected with. Until they found, I think it's in 1961, they found in Caesarea an inscription that mentions his name. And here's the inscription. It says the Tiberium, which was a temple dedicated to the worship of Tiberius, of Caesarea Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, has given. And so you find this inscription there on that building, that what was left of that building, that this was erected by Pilate, dedicated to Tiberius. And so we find in that we've got a man that still remains to us as far as historical documents, and even his name still mentioned on some things they've found here. Pilate was finally disposed in AD 36. And so he had about a 10-year reign there in Judea. It's interesting that one of the historians tells us that he fell in such calamities, and this is directly from a quote here, he fell into such calamities that he was forced to become his own murderer. In other words, what happens to old Pilate? He commits suicide. Yeah, he commits suicide. Well, now let's go back to Christ before Pilate. Go back to Luke chapter 23, verse 1 there, very quickly. Luke chapter 23, verse 1, the Jews are going to bring Christ to Pilate. It says, then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. What did Pilate know about Jesus? We don't know, do we? We don't know what he knew about Jesus. You would think he'd know something. If he is the prefect of Judea, if he is the man that's supposed to have his thumb on the pulse of the nation that time, you think he'd know something. But the conversation that they have really never indicates that he knows much at all. And one of the first things that's out of old Pilate's mouth there, of course, is about truth. And we won't have time to get into that so much here. But look at the charge that's made here by the Jews to Pilate concerning Christ. We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king. Now, is that the charge that was leveled against him back in the Jewish court? No. Now, why does the charge of blasphemy, why doesn't it make its way from the Jewish court to the Roman court? Why have things changed? Yeah, right. He would care less about blasphemy. You know, Jehovah was not his God. You know, he could care less if somebody's blaspheming Jehovah. You know, he'd join in with them. And so you've got to make a charge that would get Pilate's attention. So what's the charge here? The charge is that Christ claims to be what? A king. Well, you know, that gets his attention. Because who's king in Pilate's eyes? It's Tiberius, the Caesar back in Rome. Don't let anybody else claim to be king. That is a serious charge made here. And the Jews were not stupid. They made this charge because they knew they had to get Pilate's attention. And they had to get Pilate on board if they're going to have a capital case and convict him and execute him. And so here we've got Jesus is charged with being king of the Jews. Now, one commentary made this point, and I think it's interesting. He said that to the Jews, that meant something different than what it meant to Pilate. To Pilate would mean that this man claimed to be a physical king. To the Jews, they could interpret this to mean that Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. Think about that. And so you could say that, in essence, they were not lying in that respect of claiming, hey, the man claims to be king here. But Pilate would not have, he would not have taken that to mean, he's the Messiah? No. Claims to be a king. Well, we can't have that, you see. All right, and then we have the discussion about truth. Jesus about the kingdom. Christ answered the question about the kingdom. The kingdom's not my world. If it were, my servants would fight, defend it, my rest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place. There's a discussion then about truth. And again, we don't know exactly what Pilate meant by, well, what is truth? Is he being sarcastic? Is he being simply ignorant about that? Is he wanting to know the truth? Is he indifferent? We don't know. But what we do know is this, that Pilate tries his best to release Jesus. Anybody ever heard the book called Prelude to Glory, written by a man by the name of Wayne Leeper? I heard about this book many, many years ago and got it and read it. And what he does in the book is that he details seven attempts by Pilate to release Jesus. Now let me show you some of those attempts. We'll have to do it very quickly here. Seven attempts. What happened? Oh, it didn't transfer. Okay, it's on a no, it's mine. My fault. Okay. All right, seven attempts. Let me just give them to you really quickly here. The first attempt is found in John chapter 18, verse 31. Then Pilate said to him, "You take him and judge him according to your law." I don't want nothing to do with him. Go and take him and judge him according to your law. John chapter 18, verse 38b. And then he said he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no fault in him." That's number two. Number three is Luke 23, verse 6 and 7. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. And so he's trying to move Jesus from his jurisdiction, from his ruling, over to Herod, which is, again, you might say, an attempt to release Jesus. Another one is found over there in Luke chapter 23, verse 13 through 15. We won't look at that so much there. But again, here's a man, he says, "I find no fault in this man whatsoever." And then number five is the one that's interesting to me because he appeals to a custom. And we're going to leave this more for next week because the man we're going to talk about next week is going to be Barabbas. He's another man that somewhat gets lost in the credits, but a man that I think is worthy of our study here. But his fifth attempt there is, who do you want me to release, Barabbas or Christ? And of course, we know what the people cried out on that occasion. Number six is found over in John chapter 19, verse 4. It says, "Pilate then went out again and said to them, 'Behold, I'm bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him.'" And so he said this how many ways now? "I find no fault in him. You know, you take him, you judge him, or send him to Herod, let Herod oversee this and take care of this matter here." Now, before Herod, he says nothing, does he? Pilate, at the beginning, there is a conversation that goes on, but eventually Jesus doesn't even say any more about to Pilate. The last attempt there is found over in John chapter 19 and verse 12. "From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, 'If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar.'" And then you know the blackmail that takes place in those words there. All right, we're going to have to stop here. But Pilate's an interesting character, not so much because of his connection with Christ here at his trial, but really the man himself and what's behind this and his wife. We didn't have time to talk about his wife being involved in this also. But he's an interesting character, and I think it's one well worthy of study. All right, we'll stop here. Next week, we'll talk about Barabbas then, as he falls into the story.